Welcome back to Voices from the Front Lines, coming to you at 4 p.m. every Tuesday on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and on the web at kpfk.org. You can also subscribe to our email list for updates on future Voices show at our website, voicesfromthefrontlines.com. There you can also find past Voices shows as well as blogs, commentaries, and books. Also be sure to visit us at the strategycenter.org. This is your host, Julian Lamb. I am filling in for Eric Mann, who will be back on Voices next Tuesday at 4 p.m. And so, Voices listeners, I am pleased to play for you a recording of political revolutionary, baritone saxophonist, and cancer warrior Fred Ho. This is an excerpt of a 3-hour roundtable discussion hosted by the Labor Community Strategy Center at the Southern California Library for Social Studies and Research, honoring Fred Ho.
I belong to a new revolutionary collective in New York City called Scientific Soul Sessions. We have many different projects and work areas, including an international movement that we've ignited out of the Durban Conference in South Africa dealing with the carbon emissions. That's called Eco-Socialist Horizons. We have actually begun a socialist garden project in which we grow our own food as a part of trying to become self-sufficient and promote that. We are developing a black urban farmers market to distribute the food that we grow, but also other farmers grow. We have a Tai Chi program, and we have a wellness program. We have a group called the Raw Fight Club that was formed to promote a raw food diet. We have a study series that's addressing the topics of indigenous centrism, because we believe that the best foundations of Marxism view that the most advanced society that ever existed on this planet, in terms of egalitarianism, in terms of the condition of women, in terms of the rights of children, and in terms of the rights of Mother Earth, were the indigenous peoples of North America, particularly the Iroquois. We also come a long journey to adopt the position that we are for matriarchy, which is the opposite of patriarchy. And we are also eco-socialists in the sense that there can be no socialism or any social change or purported social change that does not put Mother Earth at the center and that subordinates humanity to Mother Earth. So I'm going to just kind of read some of the draft ideas of a manifesto that I've been working on, still a work in progress, a manifesto against manifest destiny Marxism. The concept of manifest destiny developed during the 19th century when the ruling class in the United States, in the United States of America nation state, basically wanted to present as self-evident, a priori, and inevitable not only its existence here in this part of the world, but its inevitable expansion to become the ruler of the entire world. And so this idea of destiny, in other words, something to be a priori, something that will be inevitable, something that is an assumption that is supposed to be self-evident, those aspects of manifest destiny, regrettably, were adopted, expressed, and completely entrenched in all the manifestations, theoretical and practical, of Marxism during the 20th century. And so we need an exorcism of that manifest destiny, those manifest destiny qualities and characteristics. So here it is. It's in 10 points, and I'll elaborate each point, and then talk a little bit about myself at the end. First, capitalism is the cancer for the planet. It is teratogenic, earth-killing. Cancer is the social and environmental toxicity of capitalism for the individual human being. There is a mistaken assumption that cancer is a disease. A disease is something that can be cured. Cancer is incurable and never will be cured as long as capitalism exists. Why is that? Because capitalism and cancer are the same thing. They are both accelerative malignant processes, and you cannot cure a process. You can only end it, but it can't be cured. Capitalism was an accelerative malignant process that began a while ago, but it really took off about 500 years ago. In 1492, it is an interesting marker because it basically brings to a part of the world that was pretty much self-sufficient, pretty much didn't need it, and pretty much lived, you know, in a very ecocentric way with nature. And it was by the plunder, exploitation, and expansion in this part of the world that it took on this accelerative malignant process in the sense that it became unstoppable. The wealth that it secured from this part of the world enabled it to basically conquer and subdue the rest of the world. And violence was a big part of it. But not just physical violence. A cellular transformation, a violence that was rested at the molecular level in terms of species extinction, in terms of changing forever the landscape, the geological landscape of this part of the world, and basically entrenching a toxicity, sociological and biological, that's going to be very, very hard to remove and correct. Cancer is a manifestation of that entrenched toxicity, particularly with the massive rise of industrialism 200 years ago. Cancer rates have skyrocketed, particularly in the most affluent societies, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Two, native society prior to white Euro-settler colonialism was quintessentially communist. That is, it was matriarchal, it's egalitarian, and ecocentric. And more advanced, and therefore did not need capitalism. The introduction of capitalism was the biological and sociological genocide against humans and the ecology. Three, there is nothing better about capitalist society and its commodification and massification imperatives. It destroys, alienates, and toxifies. The presumption of manifest destiny Marxism was that capitalism was somehow progressive because of its huge productive capacity, its capacity for efficiency, and so forth. But I would maintain and contend that it was not productive, it was actually destructive. And that destructive capacity takes place on so many different levels that we actually become the disease itself. Four, it is understandable that native peoples can't accept socialism as long as that socialism is techno-industrial-centric, stratified, patriarchal, and authoritarian. However, a new socialism that is indigenous-centric, ecocentric, and revolutionary, meaning innovative, experimental, and liberatory, is essential to replace capitalism thoroughly. The past can't be returned to, but we can avoid continuing the toxicities of Manifest Destiny Marxism. 5. Manifest Destiny Marxism is the plague of all 20th century manifestations of Marxism, and ironically, it is not Marxism. The free association of producers and a subsistence economy that meets needs and not wants and actualizes from each according to their abilities to each according to their needs is the ethos of the new revolutionary eco-socialism. By becoming a subsistence economy and rejecting accumulation, poverty and inequality can't exist. When all you're dealing with is not accumulation, the only thing you should accumulate is creativity, wisdom, and love. But the accumulation of anything, if that doesn't become the modus operandi of your society, your social system, then you have no inequality and you have no poverty. 6. There can be no cure for cancer, as there is no singular cause, as it is part of the matrix of modern industrial capitalist existence. When we talked about a mode of production, we actually allowed ourselves to be vulgarized. We're really talking about a mode of existence, how we make ourselves. So we make a system that is toxic, then we toxify ourselves. So we look at our characters as human beings, and to our credit, those who can resist that toxification maintain any semblance of our humanity in terms of our ability to have compassion and the ability to have creativity, the ability to make sacrifice. Those sorts of qualities, those are always damaged, and we're always forced into compromises. Whenever we have this scenario that's presented, this versus jobs and income. To swallow the jobs and income proposition is to accept the matrix and is accept your prolonged subordination and toxification, albeit perhaps in a stratified way. Some will do better than others, but it's an acceptance of that. 7. Cancer and capitalism are the same accelerative malignant processes. That is why cancer rates and types are highest in the richest societies on this planet, societies with the allegedly most advanced medical technologies, and lowest among the so-called most primitive societies. 8. Industrialism offers nothing, absolutely nothing better. To deindustrialize is what revolution must be about. Restoration of the commons, the elimination of money and the monetizing of value and worth, elimination of division of labor and alienation, elimination of gender and all forms of social divisions, for example, privileging mental over manual labor, etc., etc. 9. To fight cancer and capitalism, a cellular transformation must begin, which is what prefiguration is on the macro social level, and what the deindustrialization of our bodies, water, and food sources, as well as our mental psychological health, must be about. Revolution is the only solution, the only cure. Let me tell you a little bit about my story in the last 5 or 6 years. I was misdiagnosed with advanced stage 3B colorectal cancer in August 4th of 2006. Basically, I had to die on that day and recognize several things. One is, what was my own complicity in a carcinogenic life? And two, what was environmental social toxicity that I was a part of in which I was collateral damage, which also included perhaps my genetic history? One of the things that I came to realize about my own complicity is the following. Ego was the principal toxicity, in the sense of myself as a male Asian American struggling in the music business, in the arts field, highly competitive, infected with a lot of the ambivalence and the uncertainty and, you know, trying to basically walk a tightrope all the time, trying to make miracles every single second of the day because you never got enough money, you never got enough access, you never had enough resources, you know, and you had big ideas and big visions, and you were trying to make that happen. And so what I did to myself physically was resort to comfort foods. What were my comfort foods? Foods that were broiled, barbecued, and deep fried, and ice cream. Even though I was in great shape, I was in really good shape. I mean, you know, I could do 100 push-ups on one arm, on each arm. You know, I could swim 10 miles. You know, but I was still toxifying myself, largely through high-temperature cooked foods, because anything smoked or burnt is carcinogenic. There are two natural carcinogens that we face since the beginning of time. That is fire, carbon, the inhalation of smoke, from incense, from smoking, from smoked meats, from, you know, meats that are cooked in fire and burned, and then the sun. But since industrialism, we have flooded ourselves and the earth with probably about 50,000 different carcinogens, according to the Center for Disease Control of the United States of America. You can find it where? In shampoo, in sunscreen, which is supposed to protect you from the sun, in toothpaste, in laundry detergent. You find it in the light bulbs here, in all electromagnetic radiation. I subscribe to the belief that the reason why we have such a rise in brain cancer today is because of cell phones and cell phone technology. Another example of how modern industrial society has toxified our existence is the role of plastic. Plastic didn't exist 60 or 70 years ago. Plastic is now ubiquitous. When you throw away plastic and it degrades, it becomes dioxin, one of the most lethal chemicals ever. And so where is the highest concentration of dioxin found today? In mother's breast milk. That's how far along the food chain it's gotten. So there's no cure for cancer because, according to the Western medical science, there is no cause for it. Because the cause is the matrix itself that has been created and engendered primarily in the last 200 years, but it goes back 500 years. So for myself, elimination of ego, I'm about 98% there in terms of eliminating ego. I still have about 2% I have to work on. But that was one of the big things I had to do. Then, of course, I had to change everything. And my book, Diary of a Radical Cancer Warrior, traces in real time how I had to sort out these things. Because I was, even after chemotherapy, surgeries, et cetera, I still was getting it. And I still wasn't, I had not changed enough. So my latest book, Raw Extreme Manifesto, Change Your Body, Change Your Mind, Change the World by Spending Almost Nothing, is a method or a handbook in terms of what I've discovered as far as the benefits of going a raw food diet. Now, I advocate for a raw extreme diet for those who really want to deal head on with diseases. And all diseases are curable. So let's look at the main diseases in American society, the diseases of actually of affluence. Heart disease, obesity, diabetes, hypertension. All those are curable. All those are fixable. But the mainstream medical science wants to pharmacologicalize it by buying expensive medication, which aren't cures but have a plethora of side effects. So you watch the evening news, the network evening news, and you see all these drugs being pushed. But you notice that the commercial, most of the time on the commercial, spent citing the side effects. But the raw extreme diet works. And I'll give you an example. I went raw extreme. I cut out all sugars, including fruits, dried fruits, fruit juices, carrots, beets, corn, and tomatoes, because those vegetables have high sugar content. And in 2.5 weeks, losing a pound a day, my blood pressure was 170 over 120. It became 120 over 80. In 1 month, it became 110 over 70. I have no more hypertension problems. After trying for 1.5 years of amlodipine, the commercial name being Norvasc, the main prescription drug used for hypertension, high blood pressure. A friend of mine is almost cured of diabetes, been lifelong diabetic. His parents died of diabetes when he was in his 40s. He's almost done with that. The numbers have gone near almost perfect. In 6 months of not going extreme, because he still eats fruits and dried fruits and that sort of thing, but primarily going to a raw vegetable and fruit diet. Obesity. Well, I lost a pound a day. In 30 days, I lost 30 pounds. In 40 days, I lost 40 pounds. I had to change my clothes twice. I had to get my tailor to alter my clothes twice in that time. I stopped going extreme raw because I would continue to lose weight, and I spent too much money changing my entire closet twice. And I also like the weight that I have now because I got to carry around a 25-pound baritone saxophone, so I need that kind of bulk, if you will, to move that around. So I like where I'm at right now. I like all of my numbers. In fact, all of my numbers are great, but I still have not beat cancer. In fact, why I say my original diagnosis was incorrect is because I think that the diagnosis should have been stage 4 metastatic, because it's clear that in 4 years there were 4 tumors. Now in year 5.5 there are 6 tumors now spreading, one in my groin right now, my right lung, the other one growing in my left groin. So metastatic stage 4 means terminal. If I was diagnosed with stage 4 metastatic colorectal cancer in 2006, 92% of the people who are diagnosed at stage 4 colorectal cancer die within 2 years. Those are the statistics in the United States. And after 6 years, it's 100%. So I'm making it to 6 years right now, even though I was led to believe I wasn't stage 4, but I believe actually I was. That's why the tumors keep coming back and now in different places. But I've gotten to that point of almost 6 years because of self-healing, of learning how to now question the orders from the mainstream medical establishment and coming up with my own methodologies. And the raw food is one of the most important ones, because most people die. The morbidity rate of those who've gone through the amount of surgeries, the amount of chemotherapies, and the radiation I've gone, I should have died a long time ago. But because I maximized my personal health, I was able to keep on going and recover fairly quickly from each of these onslaughts. I'll give you an idea of these onslaughts. I've had 10 surgeries. I've used every single chemotherapy drug twice made for colorectal cancer. I've had radiation. I've used about 11 different alternative protocols, including something that's illegal. I think it's illegal in this state. I'm not sure, but it's illegal in most of the states, but 11 states in the United States, ozone treatment. I've used chaparral, Native American herb. I've done almost everything. So I'm aware of all these different alternative protocols and so forth. But the best prescription I ever had was given to me by the late Chairman Mao. He said, go work in the countryside. So I sent myself to the countryside and I worked on a farm. And here were the benefits that just changed my mind, changed my body in a short amount of time while working on a farm. One, vitamin D from the sun. Very, very important. Two, breathing fresh air, oxygenation. Very, very important. Three, drinking well water. Again, very important. Why well water? Because of the natural minerals in that water coming from the ground. What else? Eating organic food straight from the ground, even though this farm was not certified organic, and that's my problem with the food industrial complex. To be certified means spending a lot of money to go through these regulations and these annual inspections and so forth. You know, if you plant it right in your raised bed, that's organic. If you know what the soil content is, you create the soil by composting and worms, you know, it's organic, even though it's not certified organic. So eating the food straight from the ground meant higher, much greater nutritional density. So that's why I can't go to Ralph's or Whole Foods or Trader Joe's and buy their stuff, because it tastes so lousy. Because, you know, it's pulled out from the ground before it's ripe. It has to be shipped. I didn't really realize what a real tomato should taste like until I tasted the 40 different kinds of tomatoes we planted. And my mind was blown. You know, I said, this is how alienated we become. We don't even know what food should taste like anymore. You know, and the last thing was exercise, manual labor. The sedentary lifestyle that we have, what is it, children now spend an average of 8 hours a day in front of a monitor screen. That sedentary lifestyle is part of the disease of affluence. That's responsible for obesity. And obesity is the number one disease among young people from age 14 to 24. And it's more than just the food industrial complex limiting our choices and pushing what they want us to have. It's more than that. Again, one of our manifest destiny Marxism things is to blame the system. But we're implicated in it as well, because we have allowed our existence, our existence has been changed. We have allowed ourselves to compromise with it. So, for example, in my Raw Extreme Manifesto, I talk about all the psychological things you need to do to mount up that strength to resist. I don't accept the word trying. Trying is lying. When someone says, I'm going to try, right. The other thing is you have to beat yourself up and put yourself through a psychological boot camp. So I developed a method of self-contempt for myself. And what's the biggest insult you could say to me? Call me a compromiser. So anytime I felt seduced, I would say to myself, Fred, you MF compromiser. And the third thing is to reject what's being offered. So if you're with friends and they want to, you know, go to the salad bar and you know, get what they want to get, all I said to myself, I don't judge my friends, but all I said to myself, do you really want that industrial crap? That's how I described it, industrial crap. And that was, these were the psychological devices I had for myself. So to this day now, everything has changed, so I won't accept anything but this standard of food. I just won't. That's why in my apartment in New York City, my gas for the stove and oven are permanently turned off. You know, no compromise. No compromise. Those are the first two rules of the Raw Fight Club. Number one, no compromise. Number two, no compromise. If you compromise, then you're kicked out. The thing that I've learned also is that you have to admit your own weaknesses. And cataloging those weaknesses is the first step in preparing how to become a serious warrior. That's why in stratified hierarchical military, they basically destroy your ego, your sense of individuality, so that you can become, for them, they want you to become part of a team or a collective, but someone that's willing to take orders. What we have to do is put ourselves through a boot camp in which we become no compromising but ultra creative. We have to become like gorillas in a lot of ways. The destruction of ego, I think, is the most important thing and probably one of the greatest toxicities that continues in our movement, because there's so real little reward, you know, in terms of material or status conferment, that you wonder why someone continues to be an egomaniac. And that's because they pretty much enjoy that very limited fulfillment from their own egotistical gratification. I don't know if I quite explained it quite right. Even though the system will tell you you're wrong, if you think you're right and you feed on that and don't have the ability to make ruthless criticism, self-criticism of yourself, the system actually wins, because you're not able to make the transformation necessary like a gorilla to take on whatever new challenges come forward. All you have is a bag of formulas that you pull out, and that's how you maintain your centeredness, if you will. So the destruction of ego, I think, is very, very critical and crucial. Three things happened to me in this cancer war that pushed me to finally get rid of all ego, and that is death. Deciding to kill the old Fred Ho, deciding never to go back to the life that I had before, and also trying to take my own life three times. Each time it happened, it was under tremendous amount of pain. And you have to go to find your own maker. To find your maker. You have to go to hell. God is not in heaven. Your maker actually is in hell. Because then you confront everything that is poison and self-destructive about yourself. And the challenge is to get out of hell. But, you know, if you haven't completed your mission, you keep going back to hell. And so I went to hell three times. The first time I was cut open, and the surgeon didn't sew me back up again because I had so much scar tissue. He went to speak at a conference the next day and didn't tell me. So I was released. I went home. I was in searing pain from any movement. For 12 days and nights, I couldn't sleep. That's torture. And I wanted to end it. Okay. That was the first time. Second time was when I was constantly vomiting and had massive amount of diarrhea. And I was going to the toilet something like 40 times a day. And that was going on for days. And I wanted to end it. And the last time was actually after doing the Raw Extreme, being optimized, looking great, feeling great, but then all of a sudden going down the precipice. And April 1st, I'll always remember that day, April 1st, 2011, everything dropped. I was feeling so weak, tired. It's like the very life energy being taken out of you. I was in bed 23 out of 24 hours a day. I had arranged for a couple of comrades who have specialty in the biological sciences in scientific soul sessions to bring me some poison, basically. And I instructed them that I wanted the poison. I'm going to take my own life because I, for 16 days, was going into this vortex. And they refused to honor that agreement that we had made. They said to me, you have to go back under the knife again. You know, as long as we can still take this out locally, you should do it. And so I lost three organs from that. I lost my bladder, I lost my prostate, and I lost my rectum. So I have a colostomy bag and a urostomy bag. They also had to take sizable amount of muscle and skin from my thighs, left and right thighs, in order to fill up those spaces that those organs taken out had created, because when you have empty space in your body, it fills up with liquid and then you get massive infections. You know, and I had that. I had an infection one time that lasted 10 days at 105.8. At 106, your brain boils and you're dead. So I was 105.8. And luckily, my general, Auntie Green, came by in the hospital, and I had begged the orderlies, bury me in ice, and they wouldn't do it because they had no doctor's order to do it. So luckily, my friend Ann was there, and she found a garbage bag and filled it with ice from the ice machine, and drowned me in ice, and my temperature started to come down. And also, at that same time, I had inflamed intestines, meaning that from all these repeated surgeries, they cut me open one more time, and my intestines ballooned up. So nothing could pass, no water, no liquid, no food. So for 26 days, I did not eat. I lost another 40 pounds. I was on IV food for 26 days, meaning I was being fed liquid nutrition intravenously. Those are the hells you go through to face your maker. If you're going to come back out of hell again, come back from it, you have no course other than decide if you're going to continue. And if you continue, you're going to continue truly living, meaning that every ounce of your breath fulfill the mission that you have. So most of us aren't clear. What is our mission on this planet? Why are we here? These are very basic existential questions. And I've become clear. The reason why I have a few more extra days now is because the Maker said to me, you have not fulfilled your mission. And that mission is to do the music, art, and politics no one else can or will do. And that's why I'm here.
Been pretty amazing in terms of prefiguring. Part of organizing is imagining something that hasn't happened and imagining that it can happen. Imagine the Bus Riders Union before it happened. Imagine the Community Rights Campaign before it happened. And imagine this event before it happened, because when Fred and I and Diane and Robin were on some emails together, what I envisioned was, first of all, a multiracial room in South Central Los Angeles, with bus riders, working class people, LGBTQ students, kids fighting the truancy tickets, people who are planting their own gardens, people who are fighting cancer, people who are fighting cancer. As one person came up to me and said, I have to come because my father was a jazz musician who died of colon cancer, who was a communist, so I have to come. And I was like, all the interactions of why a person would want to come, and our reconstruction of community around a coherent, again, I'll argue, anti-racist, anti-imperialist frame. I don't think you can envision and prefigure without organization. I think organization is the key to any hope. What Fred and I think all of us are saying is, but what kind of organization? What's the culture of organization? What's the constant evolution of our thinking about organization? But let's be clear that the only organization we know has never worked is the thing called the individual. And that's what capitalism wants you to think about. I don't need to be in an organization. Well, no, then you're in theirs. So you're fine. You join theirs. Just understand you've joined an organization. It's just not your own. Organization is everything. Second thing that's very important that I've been want your response to, Fred, is the dialectic between continuity and change. And I would say the danger, though, of remorse and disassociation. Because I've had that tendency to sort of, aha, now I'm in a really good place, as opposed to yesterday when I wasn't in a good place. But wait, today is, what am I going to think tomorrow? If that's the model, it's a pretty scary model, because I look back at a lot of places I wish I wasn't. And I have to realize, yeah, but you were there. So what are you going to do about it? You know, that is your past. And the reason I think this is important is because I feel a tremendous continuity between Marcus Garvey and the Communist Party Rosa Parks, the Highlander School, Du Bois, SDS, SNCC, CORE, left wing of NAACP, National Liberation Front, Weatherman, Black Panther Party, Young Lords, Brown Berets, Red Stockings. If we go through all these different forms, I think it's really important to feel the continuities, because there's an effort to undo the tremendous achievement of any organization. Because every organization can be critiqued in retrospect, even by its own members, who do these horrible recantations, which the system, what does the system want when you come in front of the McCarthy period? Are you now, or have you ever been, a member of an organization, in this case the Communist Party? And what they want people to say is, I was never in the organization, or I was fooled, I was tricked, I was used. So it wasn't me, I didn't do it. Somebody else did it to me, and therefore I can undo my own history. And I think it's really important to have the continuity and the revolutionary breaks, both, in our history. And that's something that I'm just trying to grapple with. So two other things, and back to Fred. I think it's very important that mental health and psychology be understood primarily in a collective context. That is to say, I'll give you two examples. The Bus Riders Union has achieved a lot of things. And I know you hear us about 50-cent fare and $20 passes. But at the core of it is the humiliation of oppressed nationality, working-class people and women on the buses of Los Angeles, and what that experience is like, being groped, being late to work, being in control of your own destiny, waking up in the morning having to take a bus an hour earlier because you're on a job that has a time clock. And if you're 1 minute late, you can get fired. So in order to be not 1 minute late because the MTA is not reliable, you get up an hour earlier to get on a bus that might get you there a minute early or an hour early. But the key is the boss will not let you be late. And for that split second, I envisioned a bus system with 500,000 white men in it, which of course is incomprehensible, but it's right. They could be the poorest white people in the world, and they would not be treated the way bus riders are treated today. And secondly, when we did the thing about the truancy tickets, what the kids were saying is, I was 1 minute late for school, and I was arrested by a cop. 1 minute late for school, and I was arrested by a cop on truancy. And I felt that I was humiliating my mother, because I had to go home and tell her I had a $250 ticket, that she's making $6 an hour, divide 6 into 250, and figure out what the cost was to her family. The point is, it's the mass humiliation, the mass national oppression, that the psychology of the oppressed in a collective context is what gives us the chance for collective organizing. And finally, I want to talk about the role of jazz. This is sort of very personal and dangerous to say, but I envision the strategy center sometimes as a Duke Ellington big band. Because I don't know jazz like you all, but I do. There's a section in my book about sings with the choir but finds her own voice, and I use Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers as my example. And the thing I remembered about when I heard, the thing that made me understand about Duke Ellington is when some guy said, I would rather be the second clarinetist in the Duke Ellington band than form my own. Because that's where greatness was, is the collectivity and the kind of Seven Samurai and grabbing the absolute best group of people who wanted to play together is something, Fred, that is maybe the most amazing thing I heard. You know, every day you heard something new from Fred. But I think the big band theory, thank you, Robin, is another amazing aspect of getting to know Fred Ho.
I echo your views, Eric, because collective is essential for transcendence. If collective means uniformity or mediocrity, I don't want to be part of it. But if collective is the catalyst for transcendence, for creativity, which most of the times, if it's done right, because it can be done wrong, if it's done right, then it's magical. Here are the criteria for transcendence that I have. One, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. Two, you will come up with surprises you never planned for that will be better than what you planned for. Three, the vanguard will become both obsolete and the embryo of a new vanguard. In other words, it needs, it's like my philosophy about teaching. I'm impossible to be hired by any university, even though my stack of credentials matches or exceeds most of them. Someone just told me recently I've been nominated for the MacArthur Genius Award 20 times, and I hold the record for someone who's been nominated that high and never gotten it. So there's a reason for that. So here's my philosophy of teaching, which no university will accept. I tell my private students who come to me, you've entered a boot camp. My job is to kick your ass so you learn how to kick mine, make me obsolete, and I can retire. And I want to retire soon. So in that sense, I have a view of the collective that is selective. In terms of disassociation, recantation, continuity change, something Mo Nishida, a longtime veteran revolutionary who's here today, he always teaches me a lot of things. And one of the things that we were talking about was, in the past we had such hardcore, rough struggle, that a lot of people burned out or they dropped out. And they're not contributing anything today, even though, there was a lot of folks. I mean, my legacy of liberation, one of the things I assert in my introduction is that during the late 60s and 70s, the brightest and the best Asian Pacific Americans did not want to join the system. They wanted to become revolutionaries. The brightest and the best, they didn't, some of them went to the best schools, Stanford, the Ivy Leagues and so forth, but, they were committed to something because they saw that the system was actually mediocre, because the system was boring. The system was incapable of matching the zeal, the energy, the thinking that they had because they were thinking about, how to change the world. And we lost a lot of them. And I confess myself, I was a hard ass in these sessions too, and they burned out or dropped out. And Mo said to me, yeah, that was a big waste. It was a waste. We wasted a lot of time and energy in the sense that people, when you struggle with them, need to reach a higher capacity of commitment, creativity, and clarity. Not give up. And they give up is because you basically stomped them so hard, without a spirit of generosity or compassion, and they say, I didn't sign up for this. That's when democratic centralism, and I have, a complex view on it. I haven't rejected it. I don't totally accept how we did. I think most of the way we implemented it was wrong, but I haven't completely rejected it. Basically, it adopted the same ethos as the military were fighting. Commandism, leadership that's unquestioned. It's unquestioned because unlike even the mainstream military, you didn't earn your rank, you were anointed it. How could Jerry Tung, for instance, be the clearest? What God gave him that? At some point I described it, and it's a correct criticism, of cult of personality, but it goes even deeper than that. Why did we allow it? Why did we accept it? Why did we believe in it? Why do we participate in it? All these kinds of things. So it comes to the mental health of ourselves and the psychology of ourselves that we still believe in this idea of the individual genius, the individual greatness, and all that kind of stuff. And we don't question that. Because what I've learned is that the boot camp of my struggles in my life and the people who put those boot camps on me made me stronger, made me better, but I went through a boot camp, we all have to go through those, if we're going to really make the kind of growth for not only a lifetime, but even beyond our lifetime so that people say, "Wow, he's finally gone. Thank God." You know, or we'll say, "Wow, remember when he said this?" Or remember when this was done? It stays as a legacy that continues to stay dynamic. You know, if you listen to any of the great artists, no matter how old or when the record was done, or even how smashed they were, the greatness there, you always hear something new and fresh. You know, the Monk biography that Robin did, you know, is like Monk's music. You can keep going back to it and learn so much from it. Even the small little things, like, you know, I was telling Robin, one of the things that will always stick to me is the account that he says when Monk's agent, you know, Harry Columbi, called Max Roach for some advice about how to get bookings and stuff, and Max said, "Look up Downbeat Magazine, click." You know, and I said, "Okay, we've all faced that when you go to someone who you think is going to be an elder or someone of support and get rejected and turned off or the door slammed in your face." Okay, I'm not putting down Max because I love Max. But, you know, you face these things, and those stories illuminate you about our humanity, particularly our faults and our weaknesses and how much more we can do to work on it. And I think that we're always constantly a work in progress. That's why improvisation is always, to me, the most dynamic art form. You know, because it is collective, it is interactive, and it's transcendent. If you keep doing the same lines that you practiced, your patterns or whatever, you're gone. And it'll be somebody on the bandstand who'll say, "Ho, get off that bandstand." Okay. You know, you swallow crow, you know, and you come back more prepared.
Yeah.
Well, folks, that does it for today's Voices show. As always, thanks for listening to Voices from the Front Lines. This is your host, Julian Lamb, and I am filling in for Eric Mann. Eric Mann will be in next week on Voices. We had music, as always, from Nina Simone. You can listen to previous Voices shows at www.thestrategycenter.org and send comments to voices@thestrategycenter.org. I'd like to thank our producer, Crystal McMillan, and Tanya Bernard, who does a lot of our website graphics. Good night.